This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
U.S. intelligence reports show targeted assassinations are among the threats the authorities are tracking ahead of the presidential inauguration. Afghan police saying that gunmen have killed two female Supreme Court judges in Kabul, the latest in a string of targeted killings in the country. Critics say the European Union's coronavirus vaccine rollout lacks transparency. We'll have a report from Brussels. It's good to have you with us. Now let's begin with the United States intelligence reports gathered from social media platforms suggesting that the authorities are tracking thousands of threats against politicians, and that's happening ahead of the presidential inauguration. The online threats include calls for assassinating Democratic lawmakers, building improvised explosive devices, and using sniper rifles to kill law enforcement officers around the Capitol. This has prompted security forces to gear up for a series of demonstrations and potential violence in D.C. and at state capitals. Security measures are also being taken ahead of a planned million militia march in Washington by supporters of outgoing President Trump on the 20th of January. On Saturday, a man with a loaded handgun and more than 500 rounds of ammunition was arrested at a security post in the area. Well, I talked to political commentator Alexander Azadegan, and he believes that Trump supporters are resorting to such violence in order to terrorize the people.
You know, there's a lot of online chatter, there's a lot of keyboard bravados, a lot of keyboard cowards, really, and they're trying to terrorize the people. Let's not forget the definition of terrorism is violence being pursued for political goals. We have censorship that's coming on social media. We have an information ecosystem that doesn't have any gatekeepers anymore, and the gatekeepers who are playing that role right now are they're censoring things that should not be censored. I was reading Voltaire today, and this sentence just jumped out, which said, "Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities." QAnon now has a member of Congress on its side. This woman named Marjorie Taylor Greene, who says on the second day of President-elect Biden's tenure, she's preparing articles of impeachment. Congress should consider censoring these people.
A top aide to the U.S. President-elect says that Joe Biden will sign around a dozen executive orders on his first day in office. The Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, says that the executive orders would address the COVID pandemic, the ailing U.S. economy, climate change, and racial injustice in America, stressing that those crises demand an urgent action. Klain said that Biden will take decisive steps to address those challenges, prevent other urgent and irreversible harms, and restore America's place in the world. He noted that Biden will sign orders, including the ones for the U.S. to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord and reverse his predecessor's ban on the entry of people from certain Muslim-majority countries. In the meantime, a top aide to the U.S. president-elect has slammed the outgoing administration's decision to designate Yemen's Ansar movement as a terrorist group. Jake Sullivan, a nominee for Biden's national security advisor, says that the move would only inflict more suffering among the Yemenis and impede diplomacy to end the war. Earlier this week, Washington blacklisted the movement, with Secretary of State Pompeo accusing it of destabilizing the region. and Sana'a controls the capital Sana'a and much of Yemen's north. And that's been happening since 2014 when then-President Abdulrahman Mansour Hadi resigned and fled to Saudi Arabia. A year later, Riyadh and a number of its Arab allies launched a war in Yemen to reinstate Hadi. The Saudi-led aggression has killed tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, and devastated much of the country's infrastructure. A political commentator, Hussein Al-Bukhaiti, says that a criticism of Biden's top aide for U.S. blacklisting, Ghilan Saralegh, is just media hype, because Washington is not going to abandon its ally, Saudi Arabia, for the sake of the Yemeni people.
To be honest with you, I think that this latest statement from Joe Biden, security advisor, it actually shows that Joe Biden is not going to do anything. For him to, he's now trying to blame the Trump administration for this decision. But on the other hand, when Biden will become a president, he can actually remove Houthis from the terrorist list if he really believes that this will affect actually Yemenis. But for him to say so, he could announce that the United States will not accept and Joe Biden will not accept this latest designation and they will remove the Houthi because this will actually affect Yemeni suffering. And it's clearly that actually the U.S. policy, especially security policy, is the same either with Trump, with Obama, with Biden, with anyone. It's always help the interest of the United States and of their allies. We've seen many statements as well from the United Nations and the EU and other NGOs about the danger of this latest designation of the Houthi and that it will affect millions of Yemenis. But those statements, actually, we have heard them from the beginning about the Saudi blockade, but no one has actually directed its blame to Saudi Arabia. Those kind of statements, I just actually consider it just for media consumption.
Let's now take a look at Afghanistan. Unidentified gunmen have killed two female judges working for the Supreme Court in capital Kabul. Police saying that two gunmen opened fire on a vehicle carrying employees of the Afghan Supreme Court during morning rush hours in northern Kabul. The driver of the vehicle and one other employee is said to be injured in the shooting. No group has claimed responsibility for that attack. That's the latest in a string of targeted killings in the war-ravaged country. President Ashraf Ghani has condemned the attack, saying that terror and violence are not the solutions to the problem. Violence has surged across Afghanistan in recent months, especially in capital Kabul. Sunday's bloodshed comes as negotiators of the Afghan government and the Taliban are set to resume their peace talks in Doha. From African capital Kabul, let's bring in Amin Alami, our correspondent there. Amin, bring us some more information regarding this recent incident, the woman judges being killed.
Well, Behrouz, insecurity is on the rise in Afghanistan, and mainly bomb blasts and targeted killings are also on the rise, especially in the big cities and here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. This recent incident happened in Taimani area of Police District 10th in north part of Kabul. Interior Ministry later on the day confirmed that two female judges who were working for the Afghan Supreme Court were the target of this assassination, and both of them were killed. According to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, three others were injured as a result of this incident in Taimani area. But none of terrorist groups here in Afghanistan claimed responsibility for this incident. And a separate incident in northeastern Afghanistan in Badakhshan province, an officer of Afghan National Police were killed by Taliban militants in an overnight attack in Jhelum district of this northeastern province of the country. The rising insecurity, mainly bomb blasts and targeted killings, have been widely welcomed, denounced by not only the Afghan government but also by many local rights bodies and even international rights bodies, particularly the UN. The Afghan government says launching such attacks, mainly expanding targeted killings, is after highlighting the weakness of the Afghan government, mainly the military wings and security and intelligence wings of the Afghan government. But top governmental officials here in Kabul have repeatedly stressed that they are doing their best to win the minds of the people in order to make a united front in order to bring peace and stability in this country via backing an ongoing peace talks in the Qatari capital Doha between the representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban delegation there. But what remains to be seen is the response of these two negotiating teams in the Qatari capital Doha. The main and the major demand of the people of Afghanistan is an urgent ceasefire and putting an end to the decades-long misery of these people and violence in this war-ravaged country. Based on official statistics, over 400 civilians were killed or wounded over the past 3 months in such incidents across Afghanistan. In the meantime, the Taliban militant group has so far ignored to claim responsibility for much of such incidents across Afghanistan. But in the meantime, the Daesh terrorist group only claimed responsibility for just a few number of these incidents, mainly in the Afghan capital Kabul and eastern Nangarhar province.
So there were maybe aliens from outer space. Thank you for that, Amin Alami, our correspondent in Kabul. Now, France's cumulative COVID-19 death toll has risen past 70,000 as fatalities are shattering records across Europe. The country reported more than 21,000 new confirmed cases, raising its total to 2,894,000. Officials have imposed a curfew from 6 p.m. until 6 a.m., trying to curb the spread of the deadly virus. Anyone traveling to France from outside the EU will have to show a negative COVID test and also self-isolate for a week upon arrival. In the UK, 1,300 more people died of the virus in a single day. That's the third highest on record. 88,000 COVID deaths have also been reported out of 3.3 million confirmed cases. And that is while health experts in the EU are saying that new strains of COVID-19 underline the need to speed up the bloc's vaccination program. At the same time, critics are saying that EU's vaccine rollout strategy lacks transparency. Jerome Hughes has more on that.
Health systems in the EU are buckling under pressure from new coronavirus cases resulting from the holiday period. New variants are raising concern. Businesses remain closed. These have been identified as major challenges for the Portuguese government, which has just taken over the rotating presidency of the EU.
One of the first priorities is vaccination. Vaccination is the light at the end of the tunnel of this pandemic.
Critics say vaccination should currently be the only priority for EU authorities. The UK is approving jabs weeks ahead of the 27-country bloc. Secrecy surrounds the number of vaccines going to each EU nation and how many people have so far received the jab. The European Commission says it is working with the European Centre for Disease Control to set up an information website. And that cannot happen soon enough because a major criticism of the vaccination programme in the EU relates to a lack of data. It is simply impossible to scrutinise or compare the performances of member states. We have been talking to EU citizens in Brussels about the speed of the vaccine's rollout.
My father is 76. I don't know where it will be for him. It will be me. Maybe in 4 or 5 months. That's quite slow.
It's not easy. Yeah. It's too slow. I think the priorities are not the best one.
Trying to understand why it's so slow in EU. I don't know. Maybe we need more testing to be sure of the vaccine.
Me, I really want to live like a normal person, like you, we like the way we did. So if I have to be vaccinated, I will be vaccinated.
Cracks continue to appear within the EU's unity as countries move to secure vaccines independently of the European Commission. Adding to the woes is news that production of the Pfizer vaccine is being temporarily delayed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now taking a look at elsewhere in Europe, an estimated 10,000 demonstrators have taken to the streets of the Austrian capital to protest the COVID-related restrictions. The huge event is happening as the country is in its third hard lockdown, with restrictions expected to be even extended. Omar Lesky has more.
Thousands of people, including leaders and supporters of the far right, take to the streets of Vienna to protest against COVID restrictions.
This isn't the first protest of its kind here in Austria, and it comes as the country is in its third lockdown. That lockdown is expected to end on the 24th of January.
With hardly any masks in sight and no distance between them, demonstrators only booed and whistled when asked by the police to observe the safety rules. Many of the banners, signs and slogans repeated claims that the pandemic was part of a conspiracy in which the World Health Organization and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates were complicit.
Are you not worried about contracting the virus?
I'm not worried about the virus, because it's not dangerous for 99.9% of the population. It's not dangerous. It's just dangerous for very old, very sick people. And yes, for these people, influenza too is dangerous. COVID-19 is not more dangerous than influenza.
These claims have been strongly refuted by experts who cite evidence-based data to prove that COVID is far more deadly and significantly more contagious than seasonal flu. In fact, with the emergence of new variants, experts believe we're now in the most dangerous time of the pandemic. Demonstrators also shouted slogans against the government's vaccination program that's already well underway.
The people should decide for ourselves, and not because the law is decided for us. We want to decide, is this our body, is this our brain, our life, and not the life of the government.
With the rate of new infections still considered way too high, the government is expected to announce a further tightening of restrictions. Omar Lesky, Vienna.
Now, Mexico has recorded its deadliest coronavirus week yet, with over 7,000 fatalities. Government data indicating there were 1,200 fatalities on Saturday alone, pushing the total to 140,000. The country logged a record number of 20,500 new infections, and the caseload has reached 1.6 million. Elsewhere in the Americas, Brazil registered 1,000 new deaths for the fifth day in a row, raising the tally there to 210,000. The country has the world's second largest number of COVID fatalities after the U.S. The United States is the worst hit nation by the pandemic, over 23.7 million cases, 395,000 deaths. That's a wrap for this broadcast.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The West is obliged to lift the sanctions against Iran immediately. Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, delivered a televised speech on the anniversary of the people of Qom's uprising against the oppressive Pahlavi regime. Imam Khamenei used to address the whole nation on the anniversary of the January 8, 1978, which is 19th of Day uprising, in the presence of thousands of people from Qom in the Husseinia of Imam Khomeini. However, due to COVID-19 restrictions, His Eminence addressed the nation via a televised speech this year.
It is a correct decision. It is a completely reasonable, logical, acceptable decision. When almost all of the other side's commitments in the JCPOA are not honored, it does not make sense for the Islamic Republic to honor all its commitments. This is why, since a while ago, they are gradually withdrawing from some of our commitments. And recently, too, they have withdrawn from some others. Of course, if they return to their commitments, we will return to ours as well. It is a source of dignity and pride for the country. Of course, they are working on the corona vaccine in different ways. But in one case, they are testing a vaccine on human beings and it has proven to be successful.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Importing American or English vaccines to country is prohibited. I have said this to the officials, and I am now announcing this publicly. If the Americans had been able to produce vaccine, the corona disaster would not have occurred in their own country. A few days ago, there were 4,000 deaths in their country in one day. If they know how to make a vaccine, and if their Pfizer factory knows how to produce one, they can use it for themselves so that there won't be so many deaths there. The same is true for England. They are not trustworthy or reliable. I don't know. Perhaps they wish to test a vaccine on other nations to see if it works or not. And of course, I do not trust French either. The reason is their history in giving us contaminated blood, France's HIV-tainted blood supplies.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praise.
A British judge has finally ruled on whether Australian journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange will be extradited to the United States to face espionage and computer hacking charges. I was at the extradition hearing, as well as the verdict and the bail hearing, in what many have called the trial of the century. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In September and October of 2020, the extradition hearing of journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange took place at the Old Bailey in London. The United States wants to extradite Julian Assange to face a trial over allegations that he violated the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Julian Assange published documents like the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war diaries, and State Department cables showing various atrocities and war crimes that the United States had committed overseas. The United States is threatening him with up to 175 years for the publication of these documents. Various witnesses testified on Assange's behalf during the hearing, including human rights lawyers, computer scientists, medical experts, journalists, and media partners of WikiLeaks. They argued that the publications by WikiLeaks exposed very serious government crimes and wrongdoing and were essential for the public interest. They argued that sending Assange to jail would effectively criminalize journalism. And not only that, but the fact that the United States would be able to prosecute a journalist in another country of a different nationality and the dangerous precedent that this sets for press freedoms. Finally, last week, we received a decision from Judge Baretzer. She ruled against extradition. Many were jubilant about this at first, but it is very important to note why and how she came to this ruling. Judge Vanessa Baretzer blocked the extradition of Julian Assange only on the grounds of his health. She accepted that he suffers from depression and Asperger's and agreed with the medical experts who testified at the hearing. She agreed that if he were to be extradited, there is a high probability that Julian Assange would be placed in a federal super maximum prison like ADX Colorado and under very brutal and harsh special administrative measures, which are designed to completely limit physical contact between prisoners and keep them in complete isolation. Given these circumstances, she accepted that there is a high risk Julian Assange would commit suicide if sent to the United States. Now, on the other hand, before Judge Baretzer came to this conclusion, she spent a fair amount of time going through this case and agreeing with almost every allegation put forward by the United States prosecution. She agreed with basically everything in the indictment and did not challenge the political nature of these charges. According to Baretzer, she found that the U.S. prosecutors had acted in good faith, that Donald Trump did not harbor any particular contempt for Assange, and that essentially the entire case was not political. This is, of course, absurd because we've heard not only Trump but several other officials from his administration, like the former Attorney General Jeff Sessions or U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, openly talk about prosecuting Assange. Not to mention that the very nature of WikiLeaks publications is evidence of war crimes and government secrets, which makes this political by nature. Judge Baretzer went on to accept the allegation that Julian Assange supposedly tried to crack a password with Chelsea Manning. She said that Assange's activities went beyond those of a journalist. Again, this is very dangerous as it implies that national security journalism, investigative journalism, and standard journalistic practices like protecting one's source are criminal activities in her eyes. The judge also parroted the claim by the prosecution that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks releases endangered the lives of informants, which is again completely false, and even contradicts the Department of Defense's own findings that no one has ever been harmed by the publications of WikiLeaks. What is also astonishing is that Judge Baretzer refused to even take into account the fact that the United States intelligence services hired a Spanish company named UC Global to spy on Assange while he was inside the Ecuadorian embassy. She said that this was because the trial against the company's founder, David Morales, was still ongoing in Spain, and she didn't want to make a decision without having all of the evidence. Okay, well, how can she say then that this case is not political if the Spanish court case has not been concluded? In her ruling, Judge Baretzer also said that she thinks Julian Assange would be afforded constitutional protections and receive a fair trial. She did not think, for example, that his right to a fair trial under Article 6 of the European Convention of Human Rights would be violated. But again, how can she say this when we know that the United States is going after Assange with charges of espionage, which is a political crime. And when we know that the United States spied on Julian Assange and his conversations with his lawyers, not to mention that when Julian Assange was arrested and dragged out of the embassy in April of 2019, his personal effects were taken and passed along to the United States, meaning that the United States could use all of this tainted evidence against him in a trial, which by definition would make it unfair. Now, we also know that a trial in the United States would most likely take place at the Alexandria Division of the Eastern District of Virginia. This is the jurisdiction of the so-called espionage court, which is where the indictments were issued against Julian Assange and others like Snowden, Manning, McKinnon, and Lori Love. The jury pool would be made up mostly of people who work for or who have family in the intelligence community, people who hate Julian Assange. Shockingly enough, Judge Varetzer didn't seem to think that this is a problem and took the word of federal prosecutor AUSA Kronberg that the jury would be impartial. All in all, this ruling by Judge Varetzer makes one thing very clear. The United Kingdom is prepared to uphold the political charges put forward by the United States, which leaves the door wide open for future journalists to be prosecuted and persecuted by the U.S. According to her judgment, if Assange was in perfect health, then she would essentially have extradited him, which is very frightening. Now, even though the judge ruled in Assange's favor, he was not free to go just yet. The prosecution, on behalf of the U.S., said that they would appeal her decision not to extradite. And so Varetzer asked Assange's team if they would like to make a bail application for him. While his defense did say that they had the strongest grounds for bail to be granted, they decided to make the application 2 days later, on January 6th. So on January 6th, we had the bail hearing. I was again granted access to the court via remote video, and I was able to cover it. This took place not at the Old Bailey, like the extradition hearing and the verdict, but instead at Westminster Magistrates Court, also in London. It is very important to remember that since April 2019, Julian Assange has been held at HMP Belmarsh, which is a Category A maximum security men's prison on the outskirts of London. He was given the maximum sentence of 50 weeks for allegedly absconding bail in 2012, which was really just a way to punish him and give the United States ample time to prepare an indictment against him. So even after completing his sentence, he was still kept there and has been unable to leave. I visited the outside of this prison in October after covering the extradition hearing. It is truly a grim place where the worst of criminals are sent. The fact that Julian Assange was sent there at all speaks volumes as to the political nature of his persecution. The fact the United Kingdom is putting a man, a journalist, in a maximum security prison with terrorists and murderers is astonishing. Now, when the bail hearing took place on January 6th, the prosecution argued that Assange was a flight risk because he had previously failed to surrender himself to the courts after he sought refuge and political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in 2012. They also cited the potential of other nations willing to offer him asylum and referred to the latest statement of the Mexican president, Andrés Obrador. The defense countered these arguments with the following. They said that since Judge Varetzer has ruled against extradition and ruled in Assange's favor just 2 days before, this meant clearly that he had no reason to abscond or jump bail because he now had the full protection of the rule of law. The fact that the judge ruled against extradition meant that he has no reason to go anywhere. The defense also pointed to the fact that finally, Assange being able to reunite with his family, with his partner and his children, would anchor him to them. And again, this would give him no reason to go anywhere. Now, regarding the claim that Assange could be given asylum by another nation or just walk into another embassy, as the prosecution claimed, the defense pointed out that these reports of Mexico offering Assange asylum had been widely misquoted. Assange was offered asylum by President Obrador, but only after the legal proceedings were to be concluded and by going through the official channels. The reason is that even if Julian Assange is ultimately not extradited, he does remain safe in the UK, but that doesn't mean that he will be safe elsewhere. For example, if he travels to another country or jurisdiction with which the United States has an extradition treaty, he could still be extradited from there. Hence why Mexico offered him this asylum, and hence why it is safer for Assange to remain in the United Kingdom, a very valid point for him not to abscond. Other reassurances were also given by the defense to the judge, including the fact that Assange would remain under house arrest with GPS tag to monitor his location in real time, and that he would be living with his partner, Stella Morris, and their two children. Despite all these reassurances and the fact that the judge ruled against extraditing Assange, she decided not to grant him bail. As I pointed out before, even people like the Al-Qaeda cleric, Abu Qatada, were let out on house arrest from the very same prison, from Belmarsh. The Chilean dictator, Pinochet, was also allowed to live comfortably under house arrest in London. The fact that Assange is a free man, guilty of no crime, and still has to go back to jail, to a maximum security prison, speaks volumes and shows that this is a purely political affair. We'll be right back after this short break. One of the more outspoken voices who visited Assange in Belmarsh with a team of doctors and said that Assange showed all symptoms typical for prolonged exposure to psychological torture is Nils Melzer. He is a professor of international law and also the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture. He joins me now. Thanks for coming on the show, Professor. It's good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, can I get your initial reaction on Julian Assange's bail being denied by Judge Barreto? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, unfortunately, I have to say I'm not surprised. I guess Monday's decision to refuse his extradition was initially surprising. I think on second thought, it is not even that is so surprising, because it could also be a quite a malicious move to reduce, let's say, the issues that can be discussed on appeal to a medical issue, and then allow the U.S. basically to just make diplomatic assurances as to the treatment that they will give to Julian Assange in the U.S. and thereby can circumvent a full discussion of all the issues that have been raised in court by the defense. The short answer really is that Julian Assange should never have been in Belmarsh from the beginning. He has been arrested. If you know, the UK insists on putting him in prison for a bail violation 7 years earlier, which is completely exceptional. It never happens in the UK that you go to prison for a bail violation unless you committed a crime during that bail violation. But bail violation itself is an administrative offense. So no one goes to a high security prison. And, you know, we have to understand that high-security prison detention is something extremely expensive. You only do that because to people that pose an imminent security threat. And Julian Assange, obviously, is a non-violent, publisher. He has been put there not because he is a security threat to anyone in terms of violence or criminality, but because he was put there to be silenced. Because obviously in a high security prison, you have a very strict security regime. You can limit visits, you can limit communication, you can limit access to, you know, internet, to working tools and so on. And that's exactly what was the intention. So to keep him there from the beginning has been unnecessary. It has been disproportionate. Once he had served his sentence, he was, since September 2019, he's there only for preventative purposes to ensure his availability for the extradition proceeding. Others have been held in house arrest for these types of things. Even former Chilean dictator Pinochet was held in 1.5 years in house arrest in the villa, received visits by the former prime minister. Could you imagine Julian Assange being held in a luxurious villa and receiving visits from Tony Blair? I don't think so. I'm making this caricature not because it's funny, but because it illustrates how unbalanced this prosecution has been, and that this has never been about the law. It's always been about politics and about silencing him and not about prosecuting him for anything he's done.
While it's good she ruled against extradition on health grounds at the very least, she agreed with everything else put forward by the U.S. prosecution. Could you elaborate on that for us?
First of all, yes, obviously, I agree that he cannot be extradited to the U.S. because he would be inhumanely treated there. And that's something that I said already on the 5th of April, 2019. He was still in the Ecuadorian embassy. And I called on Ecuador not to expel him because of precisely that risk of ill treatment and, torture in detention conditions in the U.S. Supermax conditions are recognized not just by me, but by my predecessors, by Amnesty International, basically everybody who's dealing with human rights, acknowledges that supermax detention conditions, especially under the so-called special administrative measures, amount to torture and other ill treatment, which is absolutely prohibited under the Convention Against Torture. So you can't extradite a person towards a country that practices these types of detention conditions. And the U.S. has been quite, open about the fact that that's precisely what they would be doing to him when extradited. So on that account, yes, her decision actually confirms my assessment as to the risks of torture and ill treatment in the U.S. And certainly that is something I can only welcome. However, technically what happens is obviously that all the other issues, the whole rationale that underlies the U.S. Prosecution has been confirmed point by point in a quite outrageous way, really.
Professor, you visited Julian Assange in Belmarsh prison with a team of doctors. You saw the condition that he's in. You said he showed signs of prolonged psychological torture. You saw him there, so how can she justify sending him back if the entire pillar of her judgment from Monday not to extradite him is based and rooted in mental health?
The day I visited him, the 9th of May, 2 days before, a razor blade had been found in his cell. And he actually talked to me about this when I visited him. And he also made very clear that he would not be extradited alive. So he has this determination. I think I would agree that probably his risk of suicide is much higher in the U.S. than it is in the U.K. because in the U.K. he still has hope that he might not be extradited and after that he would be released. And once he's in the U.S., he knows that he will never get out of prison again. And so it's a different kind of prospect. So I think that objectively certainly is a difference. What has to be very clearly stated, there is no justification for him to be in a high-security prison, there's no justification to prosecute him, to extradite him in the first place.
Are you holding out much hope in regards to the Biden administration? Because yesterday we heard from the outgoing prosecutor of the Eastern District Court of Virginia that this Assange case has consumed a lot of time and resources. What did you make of that report?
Yeah, I think that we should give the incoming president the benefit of the doubt. Although he has been part of the Obama administration, and unfortunately President Obama has been instrumental in destroying the rule of law and the credibility of the U.S. in terms of human rights law. I mean, we're talking about the drone killings that he has basically institutionalized, his refusal to prosecute torture by the CIA, although we have a 7,000-page report confirming all of these things. He's being hailed somehow as a human rights champion, and he receives the Nobel Peace Prize on credit. But then, what the reality of this is much more worrying. So obviously, we all know that he conducted a veritable war against whistleblowers, and yes, he did not decide to prosecute Assange, but then also he never gave him any assurances that he would not be prosecuted, which is why for 7 years he stayed in that embassy. And the Democrats were very happy having him blocked in the embassy and incapacitated in this way. And Biden has been part of that administration. So, it's open to see what he will do once he is president. It's possible that he will decide that he will not prosecute him under the Espionage Act because he doesn't want to have a confrontation with the New York Times and so on. But then he will just expand the computer fraud charges. I mean, that's a possible scenario. But we have to admit, at the moment, it's just speculation. They could be very comfortable releasing Assange based on medical grounds and keeping that kind of threat scenario pending above his head for the rest of his life, that, you know, if ever he should go back to WikiLeaks and taking up his profession again and challenge the power of the U.S. again, they will just start this whole proceeding all over again.
Going forward, how hopeful are you that the decision not to extradite Assange will be upheld, and how hopeful are you that the decision to deny him bail will be overturned?
It's very difficult to say. I think it really, you know, if we've learned anything of the last 10 years of his persecution, is that this has never been about the law. It's not been about the law in Sweden. It's never been about protecting women, against sexual violence, which is a very important issue, but this has not been the intention of the Swedish authorities. If anything, these Swedish authorities have destroyed these women's lives as well. They never cared about that. So this has been a political persecution in Sweden already. It was a political persecution afterwards in the UK while he was in the embassy, where the UK always pushed Sweden never to drop the charges, even when Sweden wanted to drop the charges. The British, for all, I mean, they were not even involved. You know, these women were not British. It didn't happen in Britain. Why would they care? Because they had a political motivation. Britain initially even wanted to storm the Ecuadorian embassy. Remember, William Hague actually threatened to storm the Ecuadorian embassy when he sought asylum there. And that's absolutely unprecedented. You don't do that because of someone who is wanted in Sweden. And I underline, he's never been charged in Sweden. He was wanted for questioning. He was wondered for questioning. You don't storm an embassy of another country because there's someone there who is wanted for questioning in a different country. So where there is smoke, there is fire, and there's been a lot of smoke in this case. And so there is a fire that is very, very important. It was always about political motivations to silence Assange. This is not about the law. Even Monday's decision is not about the law. We don't know exactly what has been negotiated, behind the curtains, but there is a political motivation behind this. And unfortunately, what happens at the appeal will be also governed by political motivation. Unfortunately, I think that's just the reality. And the only remedy against that is that the public becomes aware of what's going on and demands accountability. And demands that the law is actually being upheld.
The indictment brought forward by the U.S. effectively criminalizes investigative journalism and national security journalism. It sends a message to journalists everywhere that if they expose the United States and its NATO allies for their war crimes, then you're not safe. The fact that the U.K. is allowing its soil and its courts to be used by the U.S. to carry out political persecutions is an abomination. The judge is fully aware that he is suffering from depression as a result of years of a political witch hunt. So to send him back there is irresponsible and indicative that she is more than willing to serve the interests of the United States rather than those of a fair justice and a moral justice system. Julian Assange is not a convict. He's not guilty of a crime. He's not serving a sentence. He should not be in jail. Never mind in a maximum security prison. This is cruel, this is inhumane, and it goes against everything the United Kingdom, the United States proclaim to uphold. There can be no freedom of press, nor accountability of government, so long as Julian Assange and others like him, such as Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, are persecuted for bringing to light crimes committed by their governments. The United States will appeal the decision by Judge Bretzer and challenge it in the High Court. Subsequently, Julian Assange's defense team will also be appealing the decision of the bail hearing and attempt to overturn this as well in the High Court. Until then, Julian Assange remains locked in Belmarsh Prison, and what comes next remains to be seen. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Jamadiya Thani III. To the strongest and most probable beliefs, it is the day when the whole heavens cried for the martyrdom of Lady Fatima Zahra, the princess of all women of the world. Affliction and agony will invade hearts of all Muslims every year on the martyrdom anniversary of Fatima, a candle in the wind. والحزين ما له حضيب تعد ما يقدر يجافيني صح بفريح تيجي بتيسم والفريح ما ينسيني يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا زهرة
يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا زهرة يا مظلومة يا مظلومة يا مظلومة يا زهرة.
Lady Fatima was a daughter of Muhammad and Khadija, wife of Ali and mother of Hassan and Hussein, and one of the five members of Ahlul Bayt. She became the object of great veneration by all Muslims because she lived closest to her father and supported him in his difficulties, and because of historical importance of her husband and her two sons, and that she is the only member of Muhammad's family that gave him descendants numerously spread through the Islamic world. Muslims regard Fatima as a loving and devoted daughter, mother, wife, a sincere Muslim, and an exemplar for women. It is believed that she was very close to her father, and her distinction from other women is mentioned in many hadith. Fatima Zahra, most of all, resembled her father in her looks, character, behavior, and conduct. She's the princess of all women of the world. Various aspects of Lady Fatima's life in the words of Tahsin Fatima Razavi.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, we're going to carry on with analyzing the life of our great lady of Islam, Hazrat Fatima Zahra. And we have seen so far the role played in her short-lived life that had, at this moment and at the present time and throughout history, had mellowed the dominant roles of people and groups like the feminist, and have taught them, have taught us that by mellowing down our role and concentrating on each individual parts of our, so as to say, multidimensional role which each woman and man has to play, we have learned that there are better and supreme goals that one has to attain, and we must aim for those goals. Now, to carry on and look at the life and how Hazrat Fatima Zahra showed us these and taught us these lessons are an example from her life and her, for instance, multiple skills that she had of eloquence and her political and social expertise and the powerful insight she showed at various stages. For instance, there was a time when a woman had come to Hazrat Fatima Zahra and had said that I have a weak mother who has many questions with regards to worship. And the woman carried on asking the questions, but the questions came one after another and she carried on to the extent that she had to come another day. And the next day she apologized to Hazrat Fatima and said, maybe I have taken too much of your time. Maybe I have tired you. But Hazrat Fatima Zahra in return said, no, ask anything. It's like a man who has to transport, for instance, a load to the top of a mountain for 1,000 dinars. What do you think? Would it bother him? Because at the end, he's going to get so much money. The woman replied, no. So Hazrat Fatima Zahra said, my reward for every question that you ask is similar to imagining the whole of the space of the earth from the ground to the divine throne full of pearls. Now, with this, we see what Hazrat Fatima Zahra is trying to say. We see that if a woman concentrates on knowledge, acquiring knowledge, and then passing on that knowledge to help others to solve their problems, this is the reward we gain by helping them. There are events in the following manner about Hazrat Fatima Zahra and her bravery. She was apparently present with the Holy Prophet and at times with Imam Ali in roughly around 30 wars and battles that took place at that time. Fatima Zahra also shows her bravery when she goes into public and society and demands for her rights, for her usurped rights, namely the Garden of Fadak back, when Imam Ali, her husband, was dragged to the mosque.